So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight. Oh.
Listen to Review Man.
You see the eyes of the Undertaker. Sable has gifted him. Wait a minute! Someone got caught in the trap here! The general manager, Stephanie McMahon, is back! And she's coming to get her some of Sable!
Oh my God.
Oh my God.
Oh my God.
Shane McMahon is looking to go coast to coast here.
This is for Linda!
Oh God! That's for his mama! And falls count anywhere!
Linda, Mrs. McMahon, I didn't expect to see you here. I really didn't. I'm not sure what you're thinking right now.
Oh! Lester's taking the rest down.
And neither of us will official on him. Neither of us will referee the pass.
We need somebody.
Wait a minute.
No, Mr. McMahon with a chair in the back of Kurt Angle.
Welcome to Review Away, everybody. It's John Pollock alongside Wei Ting, and we are just hours removed from the Money in the Bank pay-per-view, but we're not going to be focusing on Money in the Bank on this show, Wei.
Nope.
We're going to be looking back at a show 8 years ago.
8 years, yes.
Eight years, Wei. It was...
Do you remember 8 years ago?
You know, I do. It was a Sunday. This was the final pay-per-view I watched with my friends before starting with The Law.
Wow.
And it was like a week before you and I started at Ryerson, and it was the start of our journey to meeting each other a year and a half after we started school together.
Okay. I didn't think about it that way. I didn't know this show was that significant.
It was a very significant pay-per-view.
Well, was it sad? Did you know that this was going to be the last show you were going to watch with your friends?
I think at that point, I wasn't aware. It was like, obviously very, they gave me a call to do the law, call screening it. And at first I was like, well, let me think about it. If I want to give up my Sundays and stuff like that. And I legitimately, the only reason I was considering not doing it was because it was, you know, I always held the pay-per-views at my house, and it was really the only time I really hung out with these friends anymore, and I felt like I would be abandoning these people if I took this gig. But at the same time, it's like I'm about to start in radio and television. I've got here a job now, granted for free, working at a radio station with a show that I already listened to.
Mm-hmm.
So looking back now, I can't believe I even considered not doing it, because had I not taken that job,
mm-hmm.
man, my life would have been very different, I think, because I wouldn't have got the Fight Network job from that.
And you would have a few more friends.
I would have a few more friends.
But screw that. Who cares?
They would have fallen out of wrestling anyway, though.
Uh-huh.
So then it would have been like a year later where...
You took a risk and you won.
I think so, Wei. Maybe this podcast would not be happening.
Maybe. Wow.
Because if I wasn't at the Fight Network at the time...
I wouldn't be at the Fight
Network. Yeah, because you meeting me was what led to
pretty much
you applying, wasn't it?
No, I was going to apply anyway. But
it was the Ryerson email, though, that
yeah,
you got, right?
Which I sent. Exactly. The fact that you went to Ryerson meant that you sent that email to the Ryerson directory, which meant that I got it.
Liz Gusecki sent it out.
That's right. Anyway...
Wow, this is all stuff for the book, eventually.
Yeah, what a great review.
This
so
is
far.
A historical pay-per-view.
I know.
Hindsight, Wei, with like, stuff I did not even realize.
Sounds like the most important show in wrestling history.
It really was. So important that I had my VHS copy of this from that night when I ordered the pay-per-view. So I popped this in, and Sunday Night Heat was on.
Wow.
To start.
Did you watch it?
I watched the one match. I only recorded the match that was on this Sunday Night Heat, and it was Rey Mysterio defending the Cruiserweight title against Shannon Moore.
Wow.
Rey Mysterio couldn't get on to the pay-per-view.
Yeah.
Well, so he was booked in a match that went 2 minutes and 1 second. And really quick here, because it was a quick match, Tilt-A-Whirl head scissors by Mysterio, hip toss to Rey into the turnbuckle. Then Mysterio came back with a springboard senton, runs into a back elbow by Shannon, and then hits a corkscrew off the top for a two count. Moore throws a tantrum. Then he gets knocked into the 619 position. Rey slips on the apron as he goes to the top rope, hits a Hurricane Rana off the top into a pin, and got the win. Bit of a sloppy finish here with Rey kind of sliding around.
What was the what was Shannon Moore doing? Was he still part of the...
He was the moron
yeah.
to Matt Hardy.
Okay. Cool.
And there was a sign in the crowd that remained there all night that said, La Parca equals ratings.
I don't know. Maybe in Mexico.
Oh.
Oh, I just meant the meaning.
Yeah, well, he still maintained a good following when he had to change over to L.A. Park.
Hmm.
So, a good transition for him.
Okay.
Well, let's get into the actual pay-per-view, because I guess that's what you saw, Wei.
Yeah, sorry. Sorry, but I couldn't get any analysis on the Heat match.
But Rey Moore, you didn't miss much.
Okay. Well, let's move on.
I was just amazed that Rey here couldn't get on to a pay-per-view when Sylvain Grenier did.
Listen, he was the Cruiserweight champion, and that if that is not a label for undercard, nothing would be. Cruiserweight title? Come on. It doesn't belong on the main show.
The show did begin with Howard Finkel, a guy who now apparently doesn't belong on television at all.
No.
He's too old to be seen.
Yet, they got the old guy to do your social media.
The old guy?
Finkel.
Oh, yes, that is true.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's one of the guys on there.
Makes no sense.
Well, I just found it amusing that the reason Howard Finkel isn't used is not because of his voice, but his look.
Uh-huh.
When this past Monday on Raw... I mean, how bad did Vince McMahon look on television? To me, he looked horrible. His tan was just gross.
That's what he thinks looks good, is the tan.
This SummerSlam event took place on Vince's 58th birthday.
Really?
That was 8 years ago. So do the math, everybody. Vince is turning 66 this year.
That is especially amazing, considering what he did on this show.
Dude, he took one of the stupidest bumps I have ever seen in my life on this show.
Yeah.
That is the tease. Howard Finkel introduces the Marine Coast Guard from Phoenix, and then Lillian Garcia sings the Star Spangled Banner.
Was there an occasion, or do they always sing the anthem?
Well, the U.S. was in Iraq at this point. I mean, they'd gone in March, so there was obviously a heavy emphasis on...
Okay.
Patriotism here, and it also bled into the first match seamlessly.
Yeah, yeah.
So we go to a video then, and they show this beach scene in this video, and then the sun descends into this ominous video for the Elimination Chamber, and it had this weird Scottish voiceover. I assume this guy was Scottish. Did you notice this?
I didn't pay attention to the nationality of the voiceover guy.
Well, it was not your typical voiceover guy that WWE uses. They have a few guys. Some of the highlights here. My God, was some of the booking horrible going into this show. This was where Kane poured gasoline onto Rob Van Dam as he was tied up backstage. This was also the build-up for this. We saw Kane light Jim Ross on fire. That was his gimmick. He torched people leading into this pay-per-view.
Mm-hmm.
We see Bischoff taking advantage of Linda McMahon against her will, borderline rape, and then to the calmest angle here was Brock Lesnar wiping someone's blood over his chest.
Yeah.
This was a far cry from PG at this point in time.
It definitely was.
Murder, rape, and I don't know, wiping blood.
Yeah. Yeah.
Infectious disease.
Yeah. Well, it was a very different time, but I wouldn't say that Brock Lesnar angle is probably the best out of the bunch. In terms of bad booking, though, if you look at Raw at this time, just
pretty bad.
Terrible.
It really was. We have Raw, SmackDown, and Stacker 2's YJ Stinger as our sponsors for SummerSlam. And as we mentioned off the top, the theme song is Saint Anger by Metallica.
Yeah.
This was like their supposed comeback album.
That's right. Yes.
This was after the whole Napster debacle with Lars Ulrich. Mm-hmm. And this wasn't this the making of this album?
Some Kind of Monster?
Yeah, was the impetus for the documentary, right? Sorry, Saint Anger was the track off of Some Kind of Monster. But then they did the documentary called Some Kind of Monster about the making of this album, right?
Because
I've seen that documentary.
I'm confused.
They made a documentary on the making of this album.
I don't... No. The Saint Anger is the album. So the next album...
Okay, the documentary is called Some Kind of Monster.
Yeah.
And there's a track on this album called Some Kind of Monster. So thus the confusion.
You're right. Yes, you're absolutely right, John.
Okay. Did you ever see that Metallica documentary?
You know what? I think I tried to catch a part of it.
It's fascinating.
I'd like to actually sit down and watch through the whole thing. I was never a huge Metallica fan, so I never had the interest.
The Chronicle, is it James Hetfield or is it Lars that goes through rehab on that thing? I think it's James Hetfield who had just come out of rehab at that point and then putting together this album. And him and Lars are like, fuck, these two hate each other, but they work really well. Their results are very strong.
I gotta watch this.
It's like fucking watching, I don't know, Steven Tyler work with like the members of Aerosmith, where it's like they all hate each other, but they work well together. It's like you and me.
Yeah.
And can't stand each other.
That's right. And that's what we'll be reviewing next week here on Review Away, the Metallica documentary.
I don't know if I want to watch it again.
Oh, never mind then.
Okay. That was just the sponsors, everybody, and the theme song. We've got Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler back when they were situated in the what I like to call the Monday Nitro position, with the one caveat that they are actually facing the ring.
Uh-huh.
That was always the joke about Nitro, was that they were always, their backs were towards the ring.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. What did they used to do on in the WWF in the early 90s and 80s? They would be positioned up there as
superstars,
well.
They were positioned back. Uh-huh. And then at one point, during Raw, I think it was an influence from somewhere, and they put them ringside at some point.
Oh, okay.
But they were ringside throughout most of the 90s.
But like, they were always facing the ring, even on Superstars? Who cares? Why are we even talking about this?
I don't know.
This is the only thing, like, imagine somebody walking in who knows nothing about professional wrestling, hearing us talk about what direction the announcers were facing in an early 90s wrestling show on Saturday.
And then we got Michael Cole and Taz for SmackDown, who are A, facing the ring, and B, ringside.
Okay. great.
This was, at this point in time on SmackDown, this was about 6 months after Paul Heyman had been taken out of the lead writer's position. And I think at this point in time, it was kind of a collaboration of Bruce Pritchard, Michael Hayes, David Lagana was on the SmackDown crew at this time. I think that was kind of the creative team, so to speak, and obviously filtered through Vince. And Vince was attached to SmackDown kind of exclusively at this point in time.
Oh, really?
SmackDown was not always, you know, a heavy... There hasn't always been that heavy emphasis, but at this time, Vince McMahon and Lesnar and Angle, they were all on SmackDown,
yes,
and Vince
yes.
was exclusive on SmackDown at this point, while Raw was kind of a Triple H's show at that point with the influence of Goldberg, and that's what was going on during this summer.
Hmm.
So we start off with tag team title match, La Resistance, Sylvain Grenier and Rene Dupree taking on the Dudley Boys. At this point... La Resistance was, I guess they were put into this real heat position because of the whole Iraq war, and here they were going to be the French guys, and for you geopolitical majors out there, of course, France had refused to go in with the U.S. and join them like the U.K. did, so not the U.K., I mean England.
Canada as well.
Canada was not going along either.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there was a big deal at the time here where Stephen Harper, who was not the prime minister at the time, it was Paul Martin here, Stephen Harper actually wrote this editorial, sent it to the New York Times, basically apologizing on behalf of Canada for not helping out.
Hmm. Okay.
Very, very controversial at the time. So if you choose not to go to war, you're a pussy, is what this tag team was representing.
Absolutely.
And they were the coward French heels.
Mm-hmm.
And did you know what they were originally going to be called?
No.
Le Coq.
Le Coq.
C-O-Q-U-E, which I don't know what it means in French. Maybe you can look it up. But that was going to be their original name. So
Le Coq.
This was the clever name that the WWE had concocted.
All right, let's see.
Concocted. Didn't even mean to do that.
Coq. C-O-Q or C-O-Q?
I think it's C-O-Q-U-E.
Q-U-E? Give me 1 second. Sorry.
Yeah.
Oh, God. You know what?
You look it up, or yeah. Don't. Bubba Ray comes out with the American flag, and it cuts to a sign that reads, 3D the Frogs.
Oh, yes, that's right.
Isn't the frogs a very derogatory term?
For French people? Sure.
I always thought it was, like, a pretty offensive term.
I don't know. Come on. Is it really?
I don't know.
It says, on Google Translate, it says it means hull. H-U-L-L.
Oh.
What would that mean?
Maybe they just found a French word that sounds like cock, and they didn't care what it meant.
Okay.
Anyway, that would have been a very... That team name would have had about as much legs as the Johnsons did.
Hmm.
Huh. Get it? Clever.
Yep.
Then they show the angle from Raw the previous Monday where 3D honors a serviceman who just happens to have front row seats in uniform. They bring him in, he waves the American flag, and then the serviceman turns heel on the Dudleys, and it's Rob Conway.
Yeah.
So here we have in 2011 way, Fit Finlay is fired for Miz interrupting the national anthem. However, 8 years ago, we had a mock serviceman in uniform who turns heel and joins the French sympathizers.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
My, how things have changed. Yeah. I wonder what the National Guard would have thought of this angle if they got classics on demand.
They probably loved it.
Loved it.
Well, weren't they somewhat involved even at this point? At least there are people attending.
And it ended on Monday with La Resistance and Conway laying the American flag over a downed Bubba Ray.
Mm.
So
what I find it kind of amusing that to represent the United States, you have people from a fictitious town in the United States.
Well, did you hear? They were announced from New York here.
Oh, they were?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't hear that.
They were.
I guess
Dudleyville is just a small borough in New York.
Okay.
Yeah, it's got its own area code and everything. The Dudleys attacked them on the way to the ring. Chants of USA. Crowd, I thought, was really hot here at the start of this match. They
really
love their
hot
American baby faces.
Absolutely.
And they hate their French heels. And Bubba Ray puts Dupree into the Tree of Woe and then steps on his crotch. The Dudleys then send both men to the floor, and the crowd is loudly chanting for tables. Grenier and Dupree then get the heat on Bubba Ray. Dupree applies a bear hug and then a spinebuster for a two count. Ray comes back, hits a Bubba bomb, and then Devon gets the hot tag, beats down both, and sends Grenier to the floor. Bubba Ray then comes back and hits the what's up spot, and then they hit the 3D to a giant pop, but Grenier pulls the referee out in mid-count, and then a cameraman runs in from behind with the referee distracted, attacks Devon, and Dupree gets the pin. Loud boos here from the audience. This one went 7 minutes and 50 seconds, and surprise, surprise, the cameraman was Rob Conway.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought this was a pretty average match with tons of heat.
A lot of heat here.
It was a simple story, you know, you're telling the typical patriotic angle, and the crowd reacted huge. Even in 2003, you could take a gimmick that's worked in all throughout history, in the 80s and such, and it still works, especially at this time. I found it interesting that even in 2003, the Dudleys were already 16-time champions. This was 8 years ago.
What are they at now? They were like 23?
Is it 23?
I don't know.
Jesus.
Spike Dudley then runs in at the end. He gets laid out. And then afterwards, Bubba Ray and Devon are walking to the back. Jonathan Coachman approaches them. And Bubba Ray yells at Coachman and asks if he is also an anti-American sympathizer. And he says, people who don't like America suck. But he gives the French guys credit for keeping the titles, but they are eventually going to win them back.
I found this to be so ridiculous, this little interview, because all Coach said was, you have to give it to the French guys. They actually put it in. What the fuck? Who is calling?
I have no clue.
Oh, you didn't pick up.
It rang once, and that was it.
Oh, weird. Anyway, I just found it very amusing, this interview, because all Coach brought up was just how, you know, you really have to hand it to the French guys. They really put up a fight. And then Bubba Ray reacts like he was just, like, coaches. He just says, Coach, are you being an anti-American right now? He just, like, came across like, you know, like any personality on Fox News, like super right-leaning guy who makes no sense and just deduces that somebody is anti-American simply because they brought up a very legitimate comment.
And then goes on to say, basically says, fuck you for insinuating that, but we do have to give it up for the French guys.
Yeah.
They did win. They kept the titles. From there, we go backstage. Christian walks in wearing the Intercontinental title, and Eric Bischoff is preparing for his match later on. Yes, Eric Bischoff is wrestling on this show. And Christian asks why he isn't headlining the show or even on the card. Bischoff blames Steve Austin, as the two were co-general managers at this point. He blames Austin for not putting Christian on the card. Christian offers his assistance for the match with Shane. Bischoff says, I already have a plan. So the idea of Christian helping Bischoff was not good enough.
No, because
for what would happen later, he had the ultimate backup muscle for this match.
Yeah, keep this in mind.
Man, this show buried Christian, by the way, everybody.
Well, he comes up, he started the segment, he comes up to Bischoff and says, I'm Christian, do you know who I am, Eric? You're Intercontinental Champion on your own brain. Christian, who doesn't know Christian?
Not Eric Bischoff. And anyway, Christian then asks, what happened with Linda McMahon last week? And Bischoff said, I will tell the world what happened later on. And he continues to shadowbox. Yes, tell us the juicy details of breaking into a woman's house and taking advantage of her.
Yeah, that's
what salacious.
That's what we all want to know. That's what we're paying for.
This was before TMZ. Then we get a video recap of A-Train and Undertaker, where A-Train cost The Undertaker a match with John Cena and then injured his ribs on SmackDown. And that takes us to our second matchup of the evening, The Undertaker against A-Train, who is accompanied by Sable. Yes. So she was on this show.
She was.
Yes. She was, of course, I don't know if you're aware of this, the poster was designed with Sable on it.
Oh, really? I thought it was someone else.
This was, to me, I worked at a movie theater at this point in time. Oh. And it was the Silver City chain, which ran all these pay-per-views. Mm-hmm. And they would not put this poster up for obvious reasons.
Huh. Is that right?
Like, really, when you think about it, it was a really stupid poster. It's like, who's going to put this up in their, like, to advertise playing this at their bar? Who's going to advertise this poster?
I'm revealaway.com. Looking at the poster.
That right poster would not get seen anywhere.
I think we
successfully killed Sable's sex appeal with that poster.
Oh, yeah, maybe. I think a lot of people would. Why not? It's not that risque. Kind of is. But.
Well, I know our movie theater. We used to have, like, the giant fucking poster that would take up an entire wall.
Oh, yeah.
Like a stadium wall.
Do you know why I always remember this poster? Is
Sable was naked?
No, it's because it is on Lance Storm's gym.
Like true. He has the master, I think, of this.
Lance Storm's gym. He. I guess he just managed to acquire a bunch of old WWE posters that are like the giant size ones that you mentioned, and he puts these all around his gym.
It's an odd image. The first thing you walk into Lance Storm's gym, like that's what's facing you as you walk into the gym.
It's Brock Lesnar's wife, right there.
That's true.
In the nude.
That's where the that's where the future is. Drawing inspiration from as they're blowing up in the ring and they look up for inspiration to get them through a practice.
I guess they see
an S covering Sable's breasts.
Uh-huh. Anyway.
So Sable's there. And the announcers mentioned that Sable gave A-Train a key to her penthouse suite for assisting Vince McMahon as a perk.
Okay.
So she's a prostitute,
mm-hmm.
is what her character is at this point, right?
Sure, yeah.
And A-Train walks down and Sable rubs his chest. And then it's all Undertaker to start this. And it builds up to the old school maneuver. Taker then goes over the top rope as A-Train ducks and is then sent ribs first into the post. And Taker goes on to sell his ribs, which they had explained before the match. We see a vertical suplex for a two count by A-Train. Then Undertaker comes back with a sleeper into a back suplex by A-Train. And then Train attacks the taped ribs of Undertaker again. Undertaker goes for the snake eyes. It's blocked. We see both deliver big boots and sends each other down. Then Undertaker goes for a power bomb, but he gets shoved into the referee. And then A-Train hits the derailer, but Undertaker kicks out. Taker goes for a clothesline, ducks, hits the referee again. This is two ref bumps in this one match.
A great sell from Brian Hebner, though, on that clothesline.
With the referee out, Taker walks into a bicycle kick, and then A-Train grabs a chair, but it's kicked into his face by Undertaker. Train kicks out at two after this chair shot, and then A-Train blocks the tombstone. Taker then goes to the choke slam, hits the choke slam, and gets the win. 9 minutes and 20 seconds, and afterwards, Undertaker, the story here was that he was supposed to show that he was impressed that A-Train took so much punishment, but in the end, Undertaker won. And he conveyed this by just nodding his head.
That really didn't come across at all. To me, this seemed like a blow-off with Taker winning despite having injured ribs.
All right.
This was just a clean win with a chokeslam.
Well, afterwards, Undertaker picks up A-Train, and to show his mutual respect, he goes to powerbomb A-Train, but then Sable walks in and tries to seduce the Undertaker by rubbing his chest. So Undertaker grabs her by the throat, and before he can do anything, Stephanie McMahon's music hits. Yeah. And Stephanie, the enforcer, runs down, administers a double leg takedown to Sable, mounts Sable, and then A-Train grabs Sable, pulls her out, and takes her to the back as Stephanie applauds the Undertaker for 5 minutes, just clapping her hands. And then she walks to the back and is clapping her hands.
I found this whole segment to be pretty obnoxious all around. And I don't see anybody, unless you're hosting a review podcast, to ever go back and watch this match. What reason would anybody have to watch A-Train versus The Undertaker from SummerSlam 2003.
The classic Stephanie return.
No one will ever see this. Oh, yeah, from what, a two-week absence?
It was the previous pay-per-view, so at least 3 weeks.
Okay, three-week absence anyway. Nobody will remember this.
This, to me, was a period in time when I was so negative on The Undertaker. Like, I thought this guy was just done at this point. Uh-huh. The previous pay-per-view before this, he was taking on John Cena. And there were some... I think Undertaker, someone in his family passed away, or there was something going on, and Undertaker didn't appear on TV at all leading up to that pay-per-view. So every week, John Cena cut a tape promo, and they were really good promos. Like, he was doing these freestyles on Undertaker, mm-hmm. cutting these great promos, and it was all like, this is going to be Cena's big coming-out match at Vengeance. He was going to beat Taker, and instead, Taker just showed up and beat Cena. Mm-hmm. I was like, what did you accomplish here? Like, Cena gained a lot of interest going in. He sold this match all on his own. There were no angle shot. There was no promos from Undertaker. It was all Cena. Mm-hmm. And then he just lost to him. Yeah. And then Cena wasn't even on this show. There was no even identity associated with John Cena on this show, mm-hmm. which is amazing when you think about it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So... at this point, yeah, this was before Undertaker, like, you could tell afterwards, like, he lost some weight, he definitely improved his cardio a lot, like, he was obviously working really hurt throughout this period of time,
yeah.
But it's like, man, you look at Undertaker, like, 5 years after this, and he was putting on some of the best matches of his career.
And the caliber of his opponents has a lot to
yeah,
do
that's
that
true,
well.
That's true, but... Even here, it was just like he was very slow and plodding. Mm-hmm. I didn't find his character engaging in the least at this point. So I was very down on Undertaker at this point. And second match on the card against A-Train, I was fine with, if that's where you're going to put him. Chris Jericho is shown backstage getting ready for the Elimination Chamber. And then we go to ringside, and Jonathan Coachman interviews a couple who he asks who's going to win Elimination Chamber, and both say Bill Goldberg.
Mm-hmm. They must.
I guess they won a contest or something,
Or maybe they just wanted to pick two people that looked like marks that wouldn't give a smart-ass answer.
They found a female.
Yes. Could you imagine if somebody gave an answer like, I know who should win, but I think Vince is going to book this person to go over because of these reasons.
They also took a big risk by doing these interviews live. Like, I'm sure they...
Well, that's why they picked, like, two people that looked just, like, you know, for sure.
Because if you don't prep people before, like, an interview, you could interview someone and say, who is your favorite wrestler on this show? And they say, Matt Hogan.
Huh.
Something like that.
No, you save that for the announcers that you hire.
Yes. Do you get the Matt Hogan reference?
No, I don't. What is that?
That was after the one of the Akalowicz shows.
What?
Where we interviewed a fan, and the girl was like,
oh, yeah.
My favorite wrestler on the show was Matt Hogan. I think she met Matt Morgan.
Matt Hogan.
But she, in her heart, believed she had just seen Hulk Hogan wrestle, maybe. Maybe that's who she had in mind. And that's who it was.
Matt Hogan.
Little did she know, and she's going to share that story to all her friends in Akalowicz. Yeah. The night I saw Matt Hogan, the Matt Hogan. So we then go to a video. Oh, fuck. This was a case where I picked SummerSlam 2003, and then I looked at the lineup afterwards and instantly regretted my decision. We harped on Shane McMahon and Kurt Angle. Is that last week's show?
No. 2 weeks ago.
That was 2 weeks ago. This one, at least in that match, we had Kurt Angle. Shane McMahon and Eric Bischoff for this show.
Oh,
fuck.
Man, Jesus, I know. I mean, this was already 30 minutes into the show, and I was already feeling sick of the McMahon involvement.
Yeah, we'd already seen Stephanie in the last match. Uh-huh. We were going to see Vince later. This was the... Rarely do you ever get all four of them. No. But we saw all four in some capacity on this show.
Yeah, well, during this whole time period, like 01 even, like starting 02, 03.
Linda was pretty good about kind of being out of the picture, but...
Yeah, well... I mean,
usually, I found they always would rotate. You never got them all at once. They would cycle. Well,
WrestleMania 2000.
That's the obvious one.
WrestleMania 2001 even. They were just all over the show. And but
I always hated it.
Yeah. Anyway, recap this brilliant angle.
Okay, well, everybody, I wrote like a paragraph just on the video here of the notes leading into this fucking feud. It all started with Kane being unmasked on Raw. Uh-huh. And that started this trickle-down effect of shit. And we see Kane... Shane went to lay out Kane with a chair. Anyway, I don't even know what this
Kane,
is.
Kane burns JR. Let's just talk about that. When that happened...
This was like one of those... jump the shark moments where every wrestling fan groaned, and it's one of the angles that is always going to be remembered, I think, in WWE. Yeah. Not, for so many reasons.
Well, Katie Vick was before this, so I would say they had
already, true.
They'd jump the shark.
Man,
to
Kane
many, many
has
years.
Survived some shit.
Oh, I know. But I just remember when this happened. JR was doing an interview with Kane.
And a sit-down interview on location somewhere.
Yeah, and then at the end of the interview, Kane attacks him and pours gasoline over him and then threatens... Austin, who was live in the arena with burning JR.
Yeah, Austin just stands there in the ring watching this like we did at home.
And he's just like, then he does it. And this was the funniest thing I had ever seen at the time.
Can't listen to me.
Somebody get in there.
Put the gas down. Put it down, Kane.
You have to think about it.
Listen to me, Kane, you sick son of a bitch.
Kane, please.
Back off.
Stop. Stop. Don't do this. Kane, don't do this.
Kane,
stop.
Kane,
stop. Kane,
put the matches down.
Come on, Kane. Don't do it.
Put him down, Kane.
Somebody help me.
Kane.
Jeff.
Guys, we need help! Get some help!
Get somebody in here right now!
Jerry, you okay?
Jeff.
Guys, we need help!
Get some help!
I remember I used
JR is selling them.
I remember I taped this. Like, I taped this for keeping afterwards. You know? He's burning him. The best part was JR was like, first of all, the cameraman is there, like, capturing all this, trying to do, like, the whole shaky thing. The idea that there was a cameraman there filming somebody as he's burning alive was funny. But the funniest was JR selling on the microphone. Like, you could just imagine him screaming off of camera into a microphone. Ah, no, don't, no. Like, how can you tell somebody to sell being lit on fire? Especially Jim Ross, you know, who's really not, I'm sorry, not the most convincing guy. And at least for all his talents on the microphone, when he's selling, he just comes across so hokey. Like, I think,
well, he's not an actor.
I know.
He's not a worker. Well, so I don't hold him to these standards of, like, they put him in these stupid, stupid situations, and when they fall apart, it's like, what did you guys expect?
This is just so...
I don't care who you put in this situation. Fucking Sidney Poitier could be lit on fire, and I don't think it would be convincing.
All right. So then...
The man's a Photoshop.
The best part is the man was burnt. And he comes back 2 weeks later to live in the arena to cut a promo, where he's talking about how he was burnt and he's very angry, but now he's normal, he's okay again.
It was like a week or two later, Jim Ross comes back. He threatens to sue Eric Bischoff for having him burnt on television, but he agrees not to sue Bischoff if he faces an opponent tonight on Raw. So Bischoff says, yeah, sure, I'll face Shane McMahon. No, you're going to face Kane. And they have their match. Kane goes to chokeslam Bischoff, but then lets him down, walks out, and is counted out. So the following week, Eric Bischoff is all happy. He beat Kane. And Austin says, I guess you didn't read the fine print of the contract, because the winner of that match has to face Shane McMahon at SummerSlam.
Oh, God.
This was such lazy storytelling. Like, this to me was week to week, shitty, shitty booking.
Uh-huh.
I don't care what people will say about the current product. This was terrible.
This was
just like fucking amateur hour, fucking second year RTA walk and talk bullshit.
Yeah.
Oh my God. This is
like
bad.
This feels like the show that somebody would book if they wanted to parody how bad the WWE was.
Like, this was, I couldn't believe watching this video. Like, you didn't read the fine print. The winner was going to shit.
Shit. Exactly. And just the very idea that, you know, the same type of bullshit with the general managers, they were relying so much on that framework of using a GM. And then to top it off.
Home invasion. Yeah.
Yeah. The thing with Linda in the hotel room.
This was the go home angle.
Oh my God. It's like, how can we make this angle even worse? Let's throw some rape in there.
Yeah. Like, this was just unfucking believable how bad this was.
What a chore it was to watch this actually week to week. I felt it was a chore even to watch it in this recap.
That's one of the, to me, 2003 was, of the last 15 years, I would say, from the 97, 98 boom period onwards, I always look at 2003 as one of the low points.
Yeah.
In the ring, it was fucking great. Awesome talent.
On SmackDown, not necessarily Raw.
You still got some pretty good, like, look at that WrestleMania we reviewed from that year in 2003. It was an awesome show in the ring. But creatively, I thought it was their worst year in that 15-year period, because it was like, the shock value was gone. Uh-huh. Being risque was done to death.
Yeah.
But WWE hadn't figured that out yet. Mm-hmm. We were still going to do stuff like necrophilia and this shit because we're still pushing the envelope when no one cared.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, okay, we're desensitized to this, but WWE had not progressed to a new level of trying.
Yeah.
That's why I almost embraced when they said we were going to go PG. I was like, well, at least this is... I'm sick of the Attitude Era and trying to hold on to this Attitude Era of just let's be controversial.
Yeah, yeah.
That period of society maybe that'll be something hip in 5 years from now, but it isn't at this point in time, and just was not working, and I really hated this year in WWE for that.
I think a lot of people, when they talk about, you know, how PG is ruining the WWE, they lose track.
Yeah, I disagree.
It is, absolutely, and they lose track at that. PG doesn't... But they assume that PG means like a John Cena type of kid-friendly promo, but it doesn't have to be that way. I mean, JR pointed out on Twitter this week how this whole past couple of weeks, how ecstatic we were about the CM Punk thing, none of it has been past a PG rating.
The whole national expansion with Hulk Hogan.
Oh, yeah.
People look upon that so fondly, mm-hmm. and that was completely PG.
Sure.
I mean, to me, PG does not mean bad comedy writing. Or, I mean, you have to decipher. I mean, I have watched plenty of movies that are PG and are fantastic. Mm-hmm. And it's a perfect example with the CM Punk stuff.
Yeah.
So anyway, that sets us up for the match, everyone. This is what we paid for. Eric Bischoff and Shane McMahon. And Bischoff comes out in a karate outfit. He gets on the mic and he asks Vince, why are you running around the country eating hamburger when you have a delicious filet mignon at home in Linda McMahon? Uh-huh. She's literally a piece of meat that I devoured. And says, it isn't a question of what happened, but how many times it happened. So he basically says, I raped Linda over and over again against her will, mm-hmm. as opposed to raping someone willingly.
Okay.
He pretty much came out and said, I raped her.
Oh, yeah. He's a heel.
And he's, but he's targeting the other heel in Vince McMahon, who have no interaction here.
What was Linda and Vince's thing at the time? What
well, was her story the like? Storyline here was Vince was fucking Sable. Uh-huh. So he didn't care about his marriage.
Okay.
And I guess Bischoff was taking Vince's seconds in Linda.
Anyway, well, who cares?
This was the storyline.
Yeah.
I'm not stretching this here. This was like what it was.
I didn't look.
And Vince didn't give a shit, and Shane did. Shane took exception to the way Bischoff was fucking his mother.
Uh-huh. Well,
and tombstoning, or having Kane tombstone her. I don't know. I don't know what was going on in this. I just wanted it to be over before it started.
Mm-hmm.
How this did not get... Maybe this did. I don't know. We should look up the Observer Awards if this got worst storyline of the year, because if it didn't, I want to know what did.
Yeah. There was probably a lot to choose from.
There's probably quite a lot. Oh, this is just a small sample of the window.
Yeah. You had the Booker T, Triple H racism stuff.
I'd say this was worse.
Okay.
I'd say this was worse. Anyway, and
Zach
then...
Gowen.
Zach Gowen. That was pretty offensive.
Yeah.
Anyway... Bischoff then says he knows where Shane gets all of his energy. And then from Linda, he's saying.
Oh.
Because he had sex with her numerous times.
That's right, okay.
So Shane's music plays, and after this promo being cut, he still has enough energy to come out doing his old dance.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Despite his mother being raped, he still comes out, and you still have to fit the dance in.
Yeah, well, he's got spunk.
Yes. Okay.
Horrible.
Let's get into this match.
McMahon attacks Bischoff, sends him to the floor. He then gets clotheslined from behind. McMahon tosses Bischoff back into the ring, into the barricade. He's just beating the shit out of Bischoff.
I guess they were really trying to sell Shane McMahon as this, like...
legit badass.
Yeah, like...
Street fighter.
You're gonna have to fight Shane McMahon. That's in the fine print. You weren't. I know. Like he was on the level of the Undertaker or the Big Show here.
Yeah.
But I gotta say, even against a guy like Eric Bischoff, I can't buy Shane beating anybody up. Like he just doesn't look like an athlete in any way.
I can buy Bischoff over Shane.
Oh, absolutely. With the
karate. Bischoff's got a karate background,
and he actually looks in shape. Shane McMahon, on the other hand, he looks like a sports fan. In his jersey, who just like sits on a couch.
A fan that ran out of the crowd, complete with shitty merchandise.
Yeah.
Wearing this stupid baseball jersey.
Maybe that's the appeal, but I can't buy him throwing punches, okay? I could buy him coming in with a chair and whacking a guy with the chair, but I can't buy him doing any type of wrestling move.
He does his stupid ollie shuffle with punches. They fight by the announce table, and this is when the big plan is revealed. Jonathan Coachman hit Shane McMahon from behind with a chair.
Yeah. Yeah, but Bischoff, before this, makes this a no DQ and a false count anywhere match.
Yes, right this before. Is where, well, the referee tries to call for the bell, and they stop him from calling for it, and that's when Bischoff announces this and tells Coach, I want you to introduce this piece of shit to those stairs.
Yeah.
And then Shane gets thrown into the steps. Bischoff tries to pin him, but he kicks out. So Shane is now overcoming two men, and Bischoff remains on the mic here as he beats down McMahon.
So he turned down Christian, your Intercontinental Champion.
For Coach.
For Jonathan Coachman. And Jonathan Coachman here, he was booked pretty solidly. He was, like, booked as the muscle.
Bischoff then cuts the audio from Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler's mics. Let's Coach call the action. This was like nails on a chalkboard here. As Bischoff kicks Shane in the gut, Coach just does his mock Jim Ross impressions. It was so horrible. Crowd hated this. They weren't into any of it. McMahon finally fights back, hits a DDT to Bischoff as he knocks Coach down. Coach then hits a low blow, and then Steve Austin's music hits. Coach gets on the mic to Austin, says that he works for Eric Bischoff, and it's mind over matter. I don't mind, and you don't matter. And they mention that Austin is not allowed to touch Bischoff or Coach unless he is physically provoked. So then McMahon shoves Coach into Austin, and this allows Austin to beat down Coach with kicks. Shane then double teams him. Austin then puts Lawler and Ross's mics back on. The match continues. McMahon takes a limp arm of Bischoff to slap Austin, so this leads to Austin stunning Bischoff. Then Bischoff pulls him up at two instead of pinning Bischoff, rolls him onto the Spanish announce table, hits a top rope elbow to Bischoff, and then McMahon gets the pin. 10 minutes and 37 seconds, and then Austin and McMahon have a beer bash after the match. Austin was the only thing the crowd was into, and I hated this whole thing.
I hated it, absolutely. It was way, way, way too long. The elbow drop was nice, though, through the table from McMahon.
Sure.
But I did not enjoy the segment. I didn't like the roles that the participants were placed in. I mean, Austin's great, but I'm just so fucking sick of this.
We got Jonathan Coachman turning heel. What a run he would have.
Well, that was actually, I mean, a huge improvement over what he was.
I don't know.
Anyway.
I found Coach the most annoying heel during that. I hated him.
But I was just so tired of the McMahons portraying themselves as top baby faces here. Or top anything. Top characters.
We had the enforcer, Stephanie. Make her triumphant return. And then badass Shane here.
Yeah.
Taking out two men.
Yeah.
What else would we see? We'd see Superman Vince later.
Yeah. And then the rape victim, Linda McMahon.
Oh, my God. Then we get a WrestleMania recall moment. This was SummerSlam, and they were already promoting WrestleMania the next year, which would be WrestleMania 20. They show Shawn Michaels being Bret Hart at WrestleMania 12. And they show Kevin Nash backstage with his goofy blonde haircut, which he had... did you remember this, where he lost the hair versus hair match to Chris Jericho on Raw?
Not really, actually. Big.
Well, they had set up a hair versus hair match, and, you know, Kevin Nash had, like, his roots and stuff, and then that Raw... He shows up at Raw with a dyed blonde hair, like telegraphing the finish that this guy was losing his hair.
Really?
So he dyed his hair because he didn't want an Eric Bischoff moment where he got his head shaved.
Yeah.
And he got his hair shaved because he was going to play that character in The Punisher.
Yes.
Jeez. I saw in theaters.
Oh, how was it?
I don't remember it that
well. He's in a Thor sequel.
Dude, he's in everything right now. He's in that Rock of Ages movie, and he's in that he's in that other Marvel movie. It's not Thor 2. It's Vengeance of something.
Really?
It's a Marvel movie. But Fuck, man, that guy's setting himself up.
Good for him.
Yeah, fuck wrestling.
Good for him. Well, he still has a contract. Like, that guy always manages to
brilliant
come out
move
on top.
Leaving TNA, in my opinion, for him.
Sure.
He's probably getting a nice little Legends deal.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll get an action figure.
He still does indie dates.
We'll get the Diesel DVD.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know about that. Do you see him in the Hall of Fame ever?
Why not?
Yeah, I
Coco
see
Coco Beware's.
I could see them like...
To me, anyone can go into the Hall of Fame. Why not Kevin Nash?
Yeah, I definitely... I think you can make a case for him, you know, with WCW.
We then go to Ric Flair backstage telling Randy Orton that the plan is Hunter walks into the chamber and he leaves his champion because Hunter's defending the title. Orton's a member of Evolution and is also in the match. And he says... Orton says he understands his job, but he keeps asking Flair, but what if? And Hunter comes in and says, there is no what if. And Orton looks like he is 15 years old here. Christ, yeah. He was young.
Yeah.
And he ends it with, I got it. What? Lines you would never expect Randy Orton to say.
No, not anymore.
I got it. He's like the goofy sidekick
here.
Yeah,
yeah.
Who is Randy Orton.
Yeah.
He's got it.
He's like Zach Morris.
He is. He was Zach Morris here.
I got it. What?
Then we go to a four-way match for the U.S. title. Eddie Guerrero defending against Chris Benoit, Tajiri, and Rhino. And Guerrero gets a big babyface reaction here.
In Phoenix.
I don't know if he was living in Phoenix at this point, but this is where he was living up until he passed away.
Is that right?
In Phoenix. They show a video of Guerrero laying out all three guys with the title. So it was basically all three guys hated Eddie Guerrero here, but he was slowly turning babyface. And then the match starts off. Furious pace these guys were working at, and when you realized how much time they got, you would understand why. Benoit goes for a crossface onto Rhino, but Guerrero breaks it and then retreats, and he'd continue doing this, where he'd let the three guys work, and when there was a submission attempt or a pinfall, then Eddie would run in, break it up, and immediately retreat out. And we see a monkey flip by Tajiri that sends Guerrero into the ropes. Running knee by Benoit to Rhino, who responds by Benoit lifts and runs Rhino into the corner. There's a tilt-a-whirl head scissors delivered to Rhino, and then a Greco-Roman knuckle lock into a Hurricanrana by Eddie off of the ropes. Extremely fast-paced match, as I mentioned here. Guerrero goes for the lasso from El Paso, while at the same time Benoit applies the crossface to Rhino, with Guerrero trying to submit to Tajiri, and the ref is checking on both. Then Tajiri makes the ropes, Guerrero breaks the hold immediately and then breaks up the crossface, and then Benoit applies the crossface to Guerrero. Rhino and Tajiri break that up. Rhino hits a spinebuster to Tajiri for a two count. Then Tajiri takes two German suplexes from Benoit. He then reverses and hits a bridging German into a roll-up on Benoit for a two count. Then the tarantula is applied to Benoit. At this point, Eddie grabs the title from outside of the ring, takes a gore, but he blocks the gore with the title. So Eddie gets up as Rhino is out cold, which was kind of interesting because they would kind of book a similar finish later on in the show. Guerrero is then kicked to the floor by Tajiri. Tajiri climbs up, but he's kicked down into the Tree of Woe by Benoit. Benoit gets on top, hits a diving headbutt to Rhino, but Tajiri breaks it up as Taz yells, "What great ring psychology!" And the finish comes here as there is a powerbomb attempt by Benoit to Tajiri. It ends with both being knocked to the floor, and Guerrero hits a frog splash onto Rhino, who is still selling the headbutt and getting hit by the title. And Eddie gets the win here, 10 minutes and 50 seconds, or 13 seconds longer than Bischoff and Shane got. No justice on this card, Way, when it comes to time allotment.
Yeah, well, 10 minutes.
I thought this was a really good match. These guys worked incredibly fast.
Everybody does very well. I really like the finish.
But it was definitely rushed.
Yeah, yeah.
So Eddie keeps the title. Probably the smart booking choice here with Eddie picking up a lot of steam. We see Shawn Michaels taping his wrist backstage. And then they show a video of Brock Lesnar powerbombing Zach Gowen repeatedly on SmackDown this past week with his mother watching, and Gowen is just bleeding from the forehead. And then a move I'll always remember, Lesnar picks up Gowen onto his shoulders on the floor right in front of his mother and F5s his one leg into the post, and then he just plummets down to the floor.
Yeah.
Holy shit, did this guy get destroyed.
It looked insane. This was also coming after an unprotected chair shot.
Oh yeah. And Lesnar then wipes the blood on his chest. They say that Gowen broke his leg in two places, and he could not compete on this pay-per-view as he was scheduled to meet Matt Hardy.
Yeah.
And then they show Matt Hardy on Sunday Night Heat cutting a promo on Zach Gowen for not competing while hurt, calls him a novelty act, and demands that the official announce him as the winner by forfeit. And Zach Gowen was not very well liked at this point in WWE. He apparently was very difficult, some people said. And Gowen's actually told the story about when it may even have been this angle with Lesnar where he legit got knocked out cold. Mm. And apparently the locker room was watching it and they stood up and applauded.
Wow.
Like, this guy had a ton of heat and he was released shortly afterwards.
Yeah, that's terrible.
It's pretty fucked up.
Was that his real mom?
Yeah, yeah, it was.
Oh, how sad.
It's legit mom who sold this well.
No, come on. Her son was getting really getting beat
up. My question was, throughout this whole thing of Zach getting beat, where the fuck was Kurt Angle?
I don't know.
Would it have not made sense that Kurt would try be involved in this Kurt, in some way? That's Kurt, the match.
Kurt doesn't like him either.
All right. So what's the point? What's Lesnar doing here? He's murdering the guy that even the babyface doesn't care for?
Maybe. Yeah. Well, so,
getting all this heat on Zach Gowen, and none of it is transferred over to Kurt.
Anyway, it all looked insane. I mean, it was done really well to the effect that they wanted to get Lesnar over as a heel. But yeah, very, very stiff-looking stuff.
Got to say, Brock Lesnar, I know he trains very hard for his MMA fights, but my goodness, his definition on this show was
a different type of training.
Very so, ripped, yeah. Different, very Scott Putski-ish.
Well, maybe he worked a lot more on his cardio.
Well, it's a lot different in WWE. You can maintain a body like that because you're only wrestling like 3 matches a year. And you're at home for like 4 months at a time training for one big wrestling match. Whereas MMA, you're on the road every week doing...
That explains it.
Yeah.
Explains why all the pro wrestlers are in such better shape.
Yeah, yeah. It's the road schedule. Yeah. Much easier.
Yeah.
So then we go to a video that recaps the Kurt Angle-Brock Lesnar feud, where Angle defeats Lesnar for the WWE title at Vengeance the prior month. And they talk about how the two became friends after Kurt Angle went under the knife for neck surgery. And they did this angle, which was actually excellent at the time, where they showed Brock Lesnar laid out backstage before a SmackDown show where he was to take on Vince McMahon in a cage match with Kurt Angle as the guest referee. But Lesnar, the babyface, said, "No, I'm going to wrestle anyway." Because babyfaces don't feel concussions. And he goes into the match, and he gets dizzy during the match, and he passes out. And Kurt is all concerned. And then, with Kurt's back turned, Lesnar does a kip-up, and he beats the shit out of Kurt Angle, and they reveal that he has joined Vince McMahon. And this was quite the swerve at the time.
Yeah.
And it paired Lesnar and Vince up together and made Lesnar your top heel on SmackDown. And that's what led to this match. This would have been their third match together, with both splitting wins at this point at WrestleMania and Vengeance the prior month.
Yeah.
And we have Kurt defending the WWE title against Brock.
I think it was just really interesting for me to think that these guys had already done this much after their WrestleMania match. Knowing how beat up both men were after WrestleMania.
And, yeah, still beat up at this point. Like Kurt had come back from his neck surgery. I think everyone agreed he came back way too early.
Oh, yeah.
And he was battling a ton of injuries going into this match. I think he had, a dislocated shoulder. He was having, a bicep issue or something like that, or a knee problem. I can't remember. But he had some, one or two significant injuries on top of coming back from neck surgery.
Just remembering back to that build to WrestleMania and watching that documentary and everything. That WrestleMania match was supposed to be Kurt Angle's final match. Like, he was already pushing it by working that match. And now, 5 months later, he's not even, four months later, he was already back in full swing doing everything.
They come down to the ring. Referee Mike Chioda gave quite the pre-match rules to these guys. It was, 2 minutes long. He's like, "Okay, guys, this is the main event for the WWE title." He just went on and on and on. So the match starts up, and it's a wrestling match to start with, where we see a takedown by Angle, a front face lock applied, and both are going back with holds and counters. And the story early on is that Lesnar is overpowering Angle during their lockups. We see a series of arm drags to Lesnar, and it's like Angle is the quicker of the two, but Lesnar has more power. And Lesnar gets frustrated after these series of arm drags, goes to the floor, and he slams a monitor onto the floor and then hits the ring steps. Lesnar then grabs the title and he goes to leave. This made no sense.
Yeah, it does. Why not?
Why would the challenger just leave with the title, the count out?
Wait, you're right. Yeah.
Lesnar was the challenger. Yeah, so yeah, this made no sense.
Yeah, you're right.
If I was Kurt, fuck it. Leave. Kurt gets Lesnar back into the ring, hits an overhead belly-to-belly, but Lesnar comes back with a press slam that sends Angle to the floor. Angle counters Lesnar's series of offense with an O'Connor roll. Then Lesnar kicks out, hits a tilt-a-whirl backbreaker. see a body scissors lock by Lesnar as Angle finally makes his way to his feet and out, hits a high angle fisherman suplex, so he takes one by Lesnar, gets a two count, and Lesnar just keeps cutting off Angle at every chance he gets and overpowering Kurt. Angle comes back with some shoulder blocks, punches into a series of rolling Germans. On this bad neck, he hits three consecutive Germans.
Oh, he does that every match.
Wow, retarded. Lesnar is then selling his left shoulder. Angle then teases the angle slam, but Lesnar blocks it. Lesnar goes for the F5, but it's countered into a DDT. And Angle then pulls down his straps, hits the angle slam, but Lesnar kicks out. Then he pulls the straps up and down again. Angle puts the ankle lock on, but Lesnar gets to the ropes. He's then pulled into the middle, but Lesnar counters the ankle lock by rolling through, and Angle takes out Mike Chioda. Angle then applies an inverted scissors lock here.
Like a standing triangle.
Yeah.
Upside down.
This was like a standing version of the Sheila Bird Kim Couture fight, if you've seen that on YouTube, where he's basically choking out Lesnar while he's on his back and Lesnar's standing. Interesting submission.
Yeah, but I thought it looked really dumb. Why wouldn't Lesnar just sit down and drop Angle on his head?
Yeah, it was. Didn't really have it applied either, but at the same time, this was 2003.
But it also, I didn't find it served really any real purpose, because at this point, wouldn't you be going for like a visionary submission reaction? But no one is familiar with this hold as a finisher. So
yeah, this
really
was like it was like a visionary submission that was designed for the people that can hear the announcers explain it, which Taz was pretty good at this point in time when it came to a more legitimate style, like calling these series of matches, like with Angle and Lesnar.
Yep.
He then applies the ankle lock, but the referee is out. Lesnar finally taps while the referee is still out cold. And then Vince McMahon, Superman, runs in and hits Kurt with a chair. Crowd is pissed at Vince. Lesnar then, he's selling the leg as he gets up, and he's hopping as he grabs Kurt, hits the F5 on one leg as he's hopping. I enjoyed this little attention to detail. And the ref counts two, and the crowd pops huge for this kick out by Angle.
Oh, my God.
Many assume this was the finish.
Angle gets his arm up at like 3.999998 seconds. He's so good at that. And what I love about it is that as good as he is to, you know, doing that, he doesn't do it every single near fall. He just like knows the precise moments for the false finishes when to pull it out.
McMahon yells at Lesnar to give him another F5. Angle counters the F5 into the ankle lock, and Lesnar keeps making the ropes, but Angle pulls him in, and finally, with Vince staring at Lesnar, Lesnar taps out.
Yeah.
Your big heel here taps out. I remember being furious at this finish, thinking Brock should have won this match.
Why?
You had heated him up. He was like a massive monster heel at this point, and then he just taps out. To me, this was like a finality to things.
Did they continue after this?
They did. It built a few weeks later. They did an Iron Man match where Brock won the title.
Okay.
So it was like you did the title change on TV.
Yeah.
To me, it's like I would have done it here, but I guess they wanted to get something else out of these two.
Yeah.
And then shortly afterwards, Angle had to go back for more neck surgery in the fall of 2003 because of a... He took an unprotected chair shot.
Oh, man.
Retarded.
I thought this was a very good match. I mean...
Yeah, I thought so, too.
When you compare it to the WrestleMania match, it didn't have the feel of WrestleMania, obviously.
No.
But I think it told a more concise story. It felt less rushed, and they didn't really mess anything up.
Yeah, I just thought on this it was... I guess their thinking was having a babyface go over when you were giving people the finish you were in the main event, but I remember at the time thinking Lesnar should have gone over here.
Right.
After the match, Angle attacks Vince while Lesnar's laid out. Then he sets up a chair in the middle of the ring, and on Vince McMahon's 58th birthday, he took an angle slam onto a seated chair.
Yeah.
Why?
For no reason. Like, there's really no reason for this. They could have gotten away with, like, a chair shot to the back, even.
This was not building to some Angle-Vince match.
Oh, no.
Or anything. It was just Vince taking a chair shot.
Yeah, this is, like, a throwaway spot that you...
And
nobody,
a dangerous one. Yeah, holy crap.
That you don't really remember afterwards. It was just, like, he did it, you get the holy shit moment, and then... keep the music playing.
It's just sort of flattened the chair. Like, this could have been serious problems.
Well, is there such a thing as like a worked chair? Are you able to make a chair out of aluminum or something? Like soft metal?
I don't think so.
Why wouldn't they?
Maybe they should. I don't know how you would do that.
Well, just
worked
make it out
aluminum.
Of, like, just make it out of some very light metal.
Yeah,
not steel.
Yeah, I don't know. Someone design it and create it. Angle yells at the end of this, "Payback's a bitch." I don't know what payback he was talking about. I don't know what...
Well, for Angle...
Because Lesnar turned heel on him?
I don't know. Whatever.
Backstage, Bill Goldberg has some headphones on. He's getting ready for Elimination Chamber.
iPod headphones.
Were they iPod headphones?
I believe so. They were white.
Was the iPod out at this point? Because that's
course.
What I thought. 2003?
Yeah.
Really?
I think it came out like 2001.
Was it that early?
I think so.
Really?
Yeah.
So he's listening to his iPod. What do you think he was listening to?
Metallica?
Maybe.
Maybe Da Rude.
Darude.
Yeah.
He's listening to music, which is a song. It's like Darude.
Oh, okay.
They show members of the Arizona Diamondbacks at ringside, and then we were zoomed in on some girl's chest, and it had a logo of the 2003 Diva Search, and then we zoomed out, and it was WWE.com Diva Search winner Jamie Cope.
Okay.
From British Columbia.
Okay.
Who I don't think was ever seen on television again.
This was like a throwaway Diva Search, wasn't it?
Yeah, this is the online one. I think she got like one photo shoot for WWE Magazine.
All right.
And that was her WWE career, everybody. But she was Canadian.
All right.
I remember one of my friends was like nuts about this chick. And he kept saying, oh, this girl's going to be the next Trish Stratus.
This girl?
Yeah, this girl.
How would he even remember her?
He followed this shit on WWE.com.
Oh, Jesus. He could tell this by the way she looked.
Yeah. He was one of these annoying friends. It was like he was a friend of a friend, and I always found him so annoying. He was one of those, I will argue with everyone for the sake of arguing, and I couldn't stand him.
Yet he was a big wrestling fan, obviously. So.
He was a wrestling fan, but
so you were torn.
Oh, he would like the stupid... Like he would have told you Shane McMahon, Kurt Angle was like the greatest match in wrestling history. Oh, and man. Believe it.
Wow.
Yeah. I remember one time what turned me off to this guy the most was when he was like, I don't think WWE will ever draw 93,000 fans again. And I was like, you know, that's not a legit number, right? And he was fucking adamant that there were 93,173 people in that arena that day because WWF would never lie about such a thing.
No, man.
And it was just like, A, you're wrong, and B, you're so adamant that you're right that drives me nuts. I couldn't stand that. I can't stand people like that.
Yeah.
If you're wrong, at least like the fact that you're wrong, you should at least have some semblance that you could be mistaken when the facts prove you wrong.
Sure. Absolutely. Anyway. Should send him this podcast.
Maybe I should. But you know what? I don't really know him that well anymore. So.
Okay.
Get a recap of the Rob Van Dam Kane feud. This was going on second from the top. Kane and Rob Van Dam.
Oh, that's fine. I mean, what's wrong with that?
No interest in the feud, maybe?
Oh, okay.
These two used to be tag partners, but then Kane was unmasked, and he feels the people are laughing at him. And we got another reminder of Jim Ross being lit on fire here. And they did these shaky graphics to emphasize the chaotic nature of the Kane character. And they showed Kane being under house arrest, but Linda McMahon ruled that that doesn't mean Kane can't go to work. And he shows up at Raw, and what does he do? He tombstones Linda at the Raw entrance onto some steps with this overly dramatic music. And then it's Shane, the savior, coming to attack Kane with a chair. And he sent Kane off the stage.
I don't know what it is, but they do all these things to Linda, all these terrible things. But I just don't take Linda McMahon as a sympathetic character, you know? Maybe because I know that she's part owner and she helped come up with some of this stuff, maybe. But I just, you could drop her off a building and I wouldn't feel bad.
I think as well, she was always put in scenes with Vince McMahon where it was like the level of character was so much of a discrepancy. You had Vince McMahon versus Linda.
And I think in order for me to sympathize with anybody, I have to actually like that person to an extent.
You don't like Linda McMahon?
There's nothing.
She seems like a nice person.
Sure.
People that have dealt with her.
Okay, well, as a viewer of her program, there's nothing redeeming about her at all.
She's just a nice old lady who wants to be part of the Senate.
There are nice old ladies that are at least entertaining and endearing. She's none of that.
Oh. Well, anyway, this whole video led you to believe Shane McMahon was taking on Kane, but instead he's taking on Rob Van Dam. And all we saw was Rob Van Dam got tied up to the ceiling backstage right out of Okaito and Samoa Joe's angle. Only in this one, Kane poured gasoline onto RVD.
All right. Oh.
So I guess the joke was RVD was on the gas. Kane comes out, taking on Rob Van Dam, and Howard Finkel just out of nowhere announces it's a no-holds-barred match.
Sorry, man. I'm just really hungry right now.
Could go for some combos?
Totally. Yeah. I'm really hungry, so if my focus is off, I'm sorry.
Well,
my stomach
your focus better be on for Kane and Rob Van Dam. There was one spot in this match where one's focus was not on, and it led to this match falling apart.
All right, let's get in. So what happens in this no-holds-barred match?
Kane knocks RVD to the floor after he guillotines him on the top rope. RVD comes back with a moonsault off of the barricade to the floor. Then Kane pulls out a ladder, which I don't think played almost any part in this match. We see a rolling thunder that's stopped by Kane in the ring by grabbing the throat of RVD, who then runs into Kane, and it sends both over the top to the floor. And this looked really sloppy. Van Dam then goes to the top. He's pushed to the barricade on the floor, and Kane runs the ladder into RVD. So sorry, there was one spot with the ladder. Kane gets the heat back in the ring, working over Van Dam. Crowd wasn't into this at all. Then Kane climbs the top rope for a clothesline to the floor from the top rope, and the crowd stands up in unison for this high spot from Kane. And what happens was Kane lost his balance on the top rope, slipped, and he fell into the ring.
Oh.
Did you not see this?
No, they must have cut it out.
I watched the VHS,
like the online DVD, I guess. They must have cut this out.
Okay.
So he fell?
You have to see
okay,
this.
Let me look it up right now.
Okay.
Kane RVD SummerSlam fall.
Okay, I'm going to keep talking about this because I want your on-air reaction to this spot, because it's one of the big botches in WWE history, I would say.
Is that right?
This match came to a screeching halt at this point.
Where would I find that?
Here, you know what? I'm going to find it.
Oh, I got it.
You got it?
Yeah.
Do you have a specific spot?
Yeah, here it is.
Okay, so you watch it and just respond.
Let me see this. Oh, God. Oh, Jesus. All right, so he's getting up. Van Dam's on the outside.
Oh! I can't believe they edited it off.
That's great. If you want to look it up on YouTube, the title of this video is Botch Number 10 on RVD, Not the Ropes.
Wow.
That's great. That's awesome. That's like Benny Hill stuff right there. Anyway. Oh, boy.
So, just a great, great moment for everybody. Next up, from there, fuck.
So,
Kane
yeah.
just went to the floor, hits a DDT. Crowd was just on Kane for this fuck-up. Then he lifts the steps but takes a drop toe hold from Van Dam, so it sends Kane face first into the steps. Kane gets knocked into the audience and then crotched on the barricade, takes a spinning leg drop from RVD off of the apron. Then we see a rolling thunder to Kane with a chair on top of Kane, but Kane then sits up, takes a running drop kick into a chair, and then Van Dam climbs to the top rope from the opposite end with Kane seated at the opposite corner, And RVD jumps off the top rope with a chair and then kicks the chair into Kane. But Kane moves out of the way, and it looked really off. It looked like he had missed.
Yeah.
I don't know what was supposed... Was he supposed to get out of the way, or was it supposed to hit? It achieved neither to me, and it just looked really
And it confused
bad.
The comment. It confused JR as well. JR thought he had hit. But, yeah, maybe it was not obvious enough that he had avoided it.
So, on the floor, Kane lifts up Van Damme. And Van Damme is doing the goofiest selling ever. His face looks like a fucking cartoon character.
Oh no!
What is happening? Dude! And Kane tombstones him onto the steps, rolls him into the ring, and pins him. 12 minutes and 52 seconds. I did not like this match, and I thought it was positioned way too late in the show.
Yeah.
They clearly were positioning Kane as a top heel, but not clicking in this match.
Well, hey, with this build, how can you not take him seriously?
So, for everyone out there watching this, SummerSlam was the setup matches because this would lead to the ultimate match with Kane and Shane McMahon at the next month's pay-per-view.
Oh, Jesus. I thought JR was really annoying in this match.
Okay? Yeah.
I thought he was exaggerating his hatred way too much, and you can just tell he himself thinks this whole thing is ridiculous. It's ridiculous. It's funny listening to him talk about his feelings towards Kane for burning him. He's caught in between playing the announcer who's completely, I don't know, removed from the storyline and calling the match, and between that and a burn victim. It's like Lawler's like questioning him, like, JR, you must have some really mixed feelings about calling this match. And JR is just like, well, yeah, you're right. I mean, you know, the guy did burn me, but it's okay now. I'm healed. Let's focus on the match. It's just so ridiculous.
He's a professional.
He just sounds so odd, and he was just exaggerating way too much for this match. Calling it like it was some war, like medieval war epic. Oh.
Backstage, Terry, who is an interviewer at this point, finds Eric Bischoff, asks him about his match. As he's being seen by the trainer, he snaps at her, calling her stupid and blonde. And then Linda McMahon walks in. This is her triumphant return after being raped 6 days ago, multiple times. She walks in and is smiling, and Bischoff is scared of her. And he's stuttering. She gives him this terrible-looking slap. I would have redone this. This was a pre-tape. But this was the shot they went with. It was horrible. Just horrible. This was like her big comeback after this angle. A backstage slap?
Oh, well, whatever.
Not that I wanted something more, but...
Like, I felt like the McMahons were in every segment of this show.
Oh, it's horrible. They go back to Ross and Lawler, and Ross calls Eric Bischoff a mongrel dog. Okay. We look at Triple H backstage. He's staring at his title. Ric Flair walks in, calls him the best wrestler alive. And he says, you're not saying goodbye to that title tonight. And then we go into the video previewing the Elimination Chamber match. It's all done to Saint Anger. And did you notice the effects on this video, Way? They really liked this shake effect.
It's done well.
It's just guys hitting each other angrily. And they're going to have a match in
sure.
a chamber.
That's fine.
So we get Triple H, Randy Orton, Shawn Michaels, Kevin Nash, Bill Goldberg, and Chris Jericho for the world title, the second ever Elimination Chamber. Mm-hmm. We did review the first ever Elimination Chamber. That was at the 2002 Survivor Series. Crowd was really into Goldberg during his entrance. And at this point, Goldberg had been in the company since March.
Yeah.
Hadn't exactly lit the world on fire. And this match, this show was originally supposed to be Triple H and Goldberg in a singles match for the world title, but Triple H tore his groin muscle, and that was why he was wearing the bicycle shorts or the taka pants, as they were referred to throughout this time period,
yeah.
because he could not work a match, and you could definitely see that from the way he was booked here.
Right.
But instead, they went with the six-way Elimination Chamber match, and that is why we got this the way it was. And Goldberg got a good reaction here, which
Huge reaction. The chancer, they're chanting his name.
He had a lot of political opponents backstage, and it was really affecting his run here in the WWE. I mean, okay. The blueprint to book Bill Goldberg was there, and this company didn't exactly jump onto it.
Sure.
But in this match, it was interesting. It starts off with Chris Jericho and Shawn Michaels. The two start with holds and counters, but the crowd is just chanting Goldberg.
Yep.
Which says something when you got Michaels and Jericho in there, and all they care about is Bill Goldberg.
Mm-hmm.
Jericho goes for the walls, but it's countered with a small package for a two count. The first entrant is Randy Orton, and they're in at the 3-minute mark instead of 5-minute intervals on this show. And Orton immediately hits a high cross onto Michaels for a two count right away. Orton then takes a back body drop to the steel floor and then a follow-up body slam by Jericho. And then Jericho applies the walls onto Michaels, but that's when Kevin Nash comes in, and he goes after Jericho for cutting his hair. And he grates the face of Jericho into the fencing. Jericho's face is bloody after this spot and gets beat down by Nash. Then Nash sets up Jericho for the jackknife, but as he's setting him up, Michaels hits Nash with the super kick, and Jericho rolls forward and pins Nash. So Nash worked all of 2 minutes and 5 seconds.
Great.
Got a main event payoff. I did not complain about this at all.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. This is such a different Kevin Nash than what he was in WCW. You know, like in here, he was like playing the serious big man enforcer like he was his Diesel. But in WCW, he was this cocky, laid-back guy who really was lazy and just focused more of his persona on his talking and his character. That's what I noticed, a very different Kevin Nash.
At the 9-minute mark, Triple H joins the match, but before he even gets out of the pod, he's super kicked by Michaels, and he would sell this for the next while. He was just pretty much taken out of this match because he was so limited physically. And then Nash comes back, he powerbombs Jericho, then he powerbombs Orton after he throws Orton into Michaels, and he leaves everybody laying. Even though everyone is chanting Goldberg. So they gave up Nash all of his heat back here, which is kind of weird because I believe this was Nash's last night with the company because
really?
He left after this to go film a movie, and he would not come back until the Royal Rumble this year.
Interesting.
So no real need to protect Nash, in my opinion. So from there, we go to Shawn Michaels is bleeding at this point. Michaels crawls over, but Orton gets his foot on the ropes at 2. Michaels does the same with Jericho. Jericho gets his foot on the ropes. And then Michaels, Jericho, and Orton, they're all standing in the middle of the ring exchanging punches while Triple H is selling in the pod. Bill Goldberg is the next entrant and the final one, and everyone is selling for him. He hits a press slam into a tackle onto Orton, double clothesline to Michaels and Jericho. Then Goldberg kicks out of a missile drop kick by Jericho, presses Jericho into the cage. Then Goldberg spears Jericho through the pod. Crowd's going nuts for Goldberg at this point. And then Michaels hits a top rope elbow drop onto Goldberg. He sets up for the sweet chin music, but Goldberg ducks it, spears Michaels, and eliminates him with the jackhammer. Then he spears Jericho and hits the jackhammer for an elimination. All of this is within a 4-minute time period. And, sorry, somewhere in there he had speared Orton and eliminated him as well. So 3 eliminations here in about a 4-minute time period. This was the way to book Goldberg. It, you know, may not be the WWE style of main event, but this crowd was going apeshit for this guy based on him just murdering everybody.
Yep.
So it's down to Goldberg and Triple H, and Flair is desperately trying to keep the pod door shut. He's leaning onto the barricade using his feet to keep the door shut, and then Goldberg just kicks and punches through the glass. Huge chance of Goldberg. Goldberg runs Hunter into the cage, rubs his face into the steel mesh, and then Flair slides a sledgehammer in as Goldberg is setting up for a spear. He goes for the spear, but upon hitting it, Triple H sidesteps him, hits Goldberg in the back of the head with the sledgehammer, and Triple H pins Goldberg, and he might as well have had a pin and stuck it into a balloon, because that's what happened to the crowd, who hated this finish.
Mm-hmm.
Hated it. It's always hard to tell. You know, timing is such a difficult thing, and Goldberg was not that hot going into this show, but on this night, with the way he was booked, this to me was the night to put the title on Goldberg.
Hmm.
And they instead stretched it out another month, and Triple H would take on Goldberg in a singles match the next month, and Goldberg won the title. But to me, I recall that being like some 20-minute match, and I just don't want to see Bill Goldberg in 20-minute matches
where he's
got to sell.
Sure.
This was, you know, people were irate at Triple H winning here.
Yeah. Yeah, the same old, you know.
And that was the finish. And then afterwards, Evolution, Orton and Flair joined Hunter. They attacked Goldberg with a sledgehammer. They used handcuffs to tie him up to the cage. He did this massive blade job, and he's all bloody as he's handcuffed, and they attack him with the sledgehammer, and that's how the show goes off the air.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You're absolutely right about this show feeling like it was just a lead-up to other things, you know? You think about SummerSlam as, like, your second WrestleMania, where, you know, you kind of have your second set of conclusions for the mid-season, but it really felt like this show was just there to build up to the next show. Very forgettable show, in my opinion. I thought Lesnar Angle was good, but nothing else about this stood out.
Yeah, especially with the roster at this point. I thought the four-way was really good, but I would have liked to see them get more time. The McMahons really brought down this show, and I thought they really made the... I thought they made the wrong decisions for both title matches, in terms of Lesnar and Goldberg.
Perhaps. I don't think this show is worth checking out at all.
Really?
No, I don't.
Wow. Well... that's our thoughts on the show, everyone. I gave this show a 5 out of 10. I thought some of the work was really good, but the booking was horrible.
Yeah.
I really didn't like the booking on this
maybe
show.
Maybe I was just so detached and I just had so little interest in it. I give it like a 3.5.
Wow. Very negative review from Mr. Tank.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Okay, so let's transition over and get your feedback to SummerSlam. And Wei, we'll start off with David Cicero. I remember the show for the screw-ups that they had happen. Kane falling off the top rope, Goldberg slipping during his entrance, and JR claiming that Orton was 21 when he entered the chamber. The McMahon-Bischoff match had its ups and downs, but overall a decent match in my eyes, and the Fatal 4-Way for the U.S. title was, in my eyes, one of the best matches on the show. Overall, I'd give the show a 6 out of 10.
Paul Sayer. I remember this pay-per-view and had a good card leading into it. Wait a second. I remember this pay-per-view and had a good card going into pay-per-view.
It was a good card on paper.
Okay. I expected Goldberg to win the world title, but in the end, Triple H walked away champion, only for him to win it on the next pay-per-view, which was a dismal run. Matches that stood out for me were the U.S. title match and Kurt Angle versus Brock Lesnar. I'll give the show a 7 out of 10.
7 out of 10. All right. We move on to Brian Camacho. No, we don't. We go to Thulani. This was the pay-per-view where I first noticed the SummerSlam swerve. Basically, every SummerSlam has been built around the veiled promise of a major title change at the event, yet this rarely ever happens, with the exception of Orton in 2004. What we were promised in the build-up to the show was not what we got. Instead of Shane McMahon versus Kane, we got Shane versus Bischoff. Oh, I was so angry. And instead of Goldberg versus Triple H, we got an Elimination Chamber match. Well, that's because Hunter was injured. I think a big part of this was the idea that SummerSlam could sell itself on name value alone. But the following pay-per-view, Unforgiven, that was a Raw brand exclusive show, needed big matches to up its buy rate. As for the matches themselves, the two world title matches were what stood out. However, as much as we talk about how WWE fucks up characters nowadays, they clearly were having the same problem back then as well. Brock Lesnar's character was jerked around so much in 03 that it became frustrating seeing this former monster become a vanilla babyface and then work as a cowardly heel all within 9 months. Either way, the match was good, but their Iron Man match a few weeks later on TV was better. The Elimination Chamber was a decent spot fest, and at least they had the common sense to cut down the pod entrance time so that the match wouldn't run so long as in 2002. But the ending was a downer, given that people came to see Goldberg win the title, not be tricked into buying the next pay-per-view. They would have, like, made Goldberg had he won that. Like, he would have come off as, like, bigger than anything on that show.
Really?
That crowd was so hot for Goldberg that I think if you had seen the title change, I think it would have left a better taste in your mouth.
Would it have had a lasting effect? Would it have affected their business?
Maybe not, but I think it would have set up Goldberg, because I remember that title change the next month completely flat.
Brian Camacho. I view this as one of the worst SummerSlam pay-per-views I've ever seen. The Elimination Chamber match didn't deliver. Triple H retaining the world title brought the event down for me. The WWE title and U.S. title matches were the saving graces for me. I give this event a 3 out of 10.
3. Go to William Young. SummerSlam was merely months after I first started watching wrestling, and I look back on it as a time when I was a full-fledged Goldberg mark. The event itself, having watched it in full earlier in the year, is fairly harmless and fun in itself. Nothing special, but enjoyable throughout. A fair amount of mediocre matches and definitely one of Shane McMahon's less spectacular outings. But the U.S. title four-way and the WWE title match are both solid. The chamber match is also memorable, but I hesitate to call it good. I find it funny how HBK and Jericho basically condense their WrestleMania match into 5 minutes, and I always get a kick out of Kevin Nash and Goldberg kicking the dog shit out of everyone. But it's a relatively weak chamber match with a bad finish. Can't wait to hear the review.
Mm-hmm. Kyle Betty, I don't think anybody remembers anything on the show except for the All-Stars slipping and falling because it was on Botchamania. The Chamber match was boring until Goldberg came out. The Angle-Lesnar match wasn't as good as a WrestleMania match, and Shane McMahon had one of his best matches, which was awful, and the build-up was disturbing. Thank God Undertaker didn't wear Velcro, or else he would have been stuck to A-Train the entire match. I admire someone who exposes themselves on TV looking like that. A fat, bald, hairy man with a bunch of piercings all over his body. By the way, do any of you guys know where the Royal Rumble will take place next year? If it is in Toronto, when will the tickets be available?
I think it was rumored for Toronto, and that site has changed. I don't know where it is off the top of my head. Mark Robinson, I thought SummerSlam was a pretty good event with some standout matches. There are a few matches from the event that stand out the most to me. I don't think anyone expected Shane Bischoff to be a classic, but I found it to be entertaining overall, with Coach's heel turn and the involvement of Steve Austin. The four-way I thought was decent, even though Eddie was technically a heel, it was impossible not to be entertained by the guy, and if I remember correctly, they turned him back babyface not long afterwards. I thought the Angle-Lesnar match was actually better than their effort at WrestleMania 19, and I enjoyed the finish where Lesnar is stuck in the ankle lock forever, going to every set of ring ropes before finally tapping out. But if I remember, after the match, Vince McMahon took a brutal angle slam onto a chair, which I cringed at. Now, I know John and Way have never been fans of Kane, but I enjoyed his heel run of that summer. They made him look like a psychotic monster at certain points, much like his first few months as the character in late 97 and early 98, and I enjoyed his match with RVD at this event a lot. I would have much rather seen these two continue their feud rather than Kane have to go into a feud with Superman Shane afterwards, which pretty much killed Kane's regained monster aura. I often use this show as an example to show others why people were beyond tired of Triple H's champion during this period.
Alexander Rios, let me start by saying that the review away Photoshop for this week is by far the funniest in a disturbing way that I've ever seen. Now that's out of the way, as much as I love the in-ring work, not just on this show but most of 03, the booking here and leading into it was a retarded mishmash. Now we got a decent chamber match to hide Triple H's injury, so I'll give that a bit of a pass. Though if he was so hurt he had to wear those shorts, why not have him drop the belt to Goldberg? And Brock Lesnar's turn from grinning babyface to cowardly monster heel was damn weak as well. Whole Undertaker had a decent match with Albert. It still felt flat and had nothing for me as I was a major Taker mark at the time. The undercard was of course stellar with the fatal four-way U.S. title match when the belt actually meant something and Kane versus Rob Van Dam. My God, as much as I love both guys, this match was a clusterfuck and Bischoff versus Shane. The only thing I remember was Jonathan Coachman's heel turn, so let's call him Michael Cole 2003. I give this show a 5 out of 10.
Corey Ferreira, I really enjoyed the 2003 SummerSlam as I did WWE in general in 2003. The main event Elimination Chamber was fun, though I am a Triple H mark. I still think Goldberg should have won the title instead of Hunter and Evolution killing his heat. The WWE title match is great coming off of the triple threat from Vengeance 2003. Considering the matches the two had in 2003 at Mania and the Iron Man match on SmackDown, this is quite good. Shane McMahon and Eric Bischoff was fun. I don't think this was going to be a 5-star match, but I enjoy Shane McMahon matches. I did like the coach interruption with Bischoff and Austin coming in and beating him down. Taker and A-Train was a fine match. I did find it entertaining with Sable trying to offer herself to Taker at the end of the match and Stephanie coming to the ring to beat down Sable, which I enjoyed. Why, you might ask? Well, I might be in the minority in the group, but I am one of the few Stephanie McMahon fans. That's right, John and Way, there is one in this group. Also, if there's going to be more SummerSlam reviews, might I suggest SummerSlam 98, 99, 2000, or 2001? Great work with the show, guys. Keep it up. Also, Metallica's The Pay-Per-View theme is awesome.
Aram Nasrallah, one of the WWE pay-per-views I have on DVD. I loved the Angle-Lesnar match, but the rest of the pay-per-view was horrible. They killed whatever heat Goldberg had. The torture match between RVD and Kane was bad. The Bischoff Coach versus McMahon match was just as weird and pointless of a match. Maybe I was just hoping they could top the previous SummerSlam, but at least they had a tag team division back then, and I was a big fan of La Resistance, and I liked Evolution, except for Triple H being Superman at this point. I remember it was around May that Eddie had his heel turn against Tajiri by beating him up and slamming him on the lowrider, but the audience cheered for it, and he automatically became a face. If I'm not mistaken, it is around this time that it happened. 5 out of 10 for me. Please do Bash at the Beach 95 at some point, with over 150,000 watching it live, according to Tony Schiavone.
Not one of them paying a cent. Ryan Daniels, I remember watching Raw and SmackDown in the weeks leading up to this for at least prior to the SmackDown-only Vengeance pay-per-view in London with my family, who we were visiting at the time, and seeing full unedited WWE weekly shows for the first time. This was just after Kane unmasked and chokeslammed Bischoff off the stage, and also when Eddie turned on Tajiri and slammed him through the windshield of his lowrider. As for the pay-per-view, I always enjoyed this show. The match sticking out most for me was the Elimination Chamber. I remember loving watching Goldberg tear through the competition like a hot knife through butter, and being awestruck as he kicked his way into Triple H's pod, cutting his calf in the process. I was really hoping he would win the World Heavyweight title that night, but had to wait an extra month for that. I also remember Angle and Lesnar having a good match for the WWE title and Kane's monster push continuing over RVD. Another thing that stands out is Metallica's Saint Anger being used as the pay-per-view theme. Overall, a good SummerSlam.
Eddie Miguez. Attaching the Saint Anger CD to this show was appropriate because everyone waiting for the show was in for a big disappointment. A year following the awesome SummerSlam 2002 event, we got this. Ray thrown into a meaningless heat match. Taker and Ape Train slowing things down. Were we supposed to care about Jonathan Coachman, a mega heel? Brock Lesnar playing the cowardly heel who needed Vince's help was awkward. And the main event, ugh. I remember my friends watching the show with me went going crazy for Goldberg as he decimated his opponents. Of course, seconds later, any chance Goldberg had as a face of the WWE was crushed and he was pinned. Yeah, I hate this show.
Alan Gaynor. A decent show, but pales in comparison to the all-time great SummerSlam from 2002. It also pales in comparison to the pay-per-view held the previous month, Vengeance, which was great. Angle vs. Lesnar was really good, but I still preferred their Mania match and their Iron Man match on SmackDown. What I remember most about this pay-per-view is how Kane, not the world title match, was the focus of Raw leading up to the show. I also remember one of the all-time worst segments occurred on Raw the week before the show, where Bischoff showed up on the McMahon doorstep and forced himself on Linda. Some non-wrestling fans were at my place when I was watching it, and I can't imagine what they must have thought of the product and me for watching it.
Joe Bray. I remember really looking forward to this SummerSlam coming in. A rematch between Lesnar and Angle, which had Lesnar heel, which suited him much better, but not the cowardly heel that he was in the match, was really good. The U.S. title match delivered. Shane versus Bischoff was good for what it was. Am I the only one who enjoyed the coach's heel character? Yes. RVD and Kane was disappointing, but Kane felt like a fresh character again. The Chamber match was not one of the ones that will be remembered, but it was still good. I was pissed at the end because I was sure Triple H would lose the title, and I was a bit of a Goldberg mark. Overall, I'd say 7 out of 10, an enjoyable show.
Yannick Fortier. Seeing the show once more is a quick reminder of how much Raw and SmackDown was uneven back then and still is, as well as one more proof that Vince McMahon doesn't like wrestling all that much. The parade of non-wrestling personalities that was Shane versus Eric suffered from bad choices. Coachman, really? And lack of Vince over-the-topness, while Kurt Angle, Brock Lesnar, Eddie Guerrero, and Chris Benoit put on amazing storytelling-filled wrestling. I'd give this show a 7 out of 10 overall. By the way, how the hell did Rhino have this long of a career? Did I miss his best matches? I don't think I ever cared for him, and he was definitely the weakest link on this show.
Rhino? I wouldn't say that.
No, Rhino's a fine worker.
Yeah. Stephen Marks, hey guys, I rewatched the show yesterday and it was quite good. Sure, we could pick up the problems with Vince and Brock being on the same side, Goldberg jobbing, or anything else in this 2003 period, but nonetheless, on paper and as a standalone show, I found it quite enjoyable. The first two matches were not amazing, but they served their purpose. The curtain jerker of La Resistance versus the Dudleys was good, and it was the start of Rob Conway's run with the stable. Taker Train was an okay match with the basic story, but I was not really into the Steph Sable post-match. So far so good until we got to Eric versus Shane. Talk about something that did last forever. It sucked. It was the only real part of the show that dragged. But after your review of King of the Ring 2001, I can buy Shane fighting someone like Eric versus one of your top stars like Kurt Angle. As bad as it was, it's still better than seeing Kurt selling for Shane. But then again, Shane would go on to fight a monster like Kane on the next month's pay-per-view. It's the Shane O'Mac syndrome. Get in the ring with someone you have no reason to be in the ring with. Moving on, the four-way was awesome. Angle and Brock was good for what it was. Same goes for the RVD-Kane match. The main event was kind of a flop. Nash didn't add much to the match. Orton was still young. Hunter was hurt. And it looked like Goldberg was still Greenberg. It looked like he murdered a few people in this match. It was not amazing. And given it was a second-ever chamber match, there were high hopes going in. But the decision to put over Triple H left a bitter taste in my mouth. What was the point of having Goldberg jobbed? You had Goldberg win the title the very next pay-per-view. Regardless of the finish on the pay-per-view, it was still a good show overall. It gets 7 out of 10.
Carlo Rossi, whatever you do with this review, guys, make it a long one. I'm taking this podcast and some others on a 14-hour drive. Keep up the good work.
All right. Well, we are doing our best.
Well, let's review it again.
Okay. Well,
the show started off with La Resistance.
Saint Anger. Blaine Vandergren, finally. The show had its ups and downs. It didn't really kick off until about the fourth match in, which was the four-way for the U.S. title. And it was a great match. Brock Lesnar and Kurt Angle was really the only remaining match that could follow it, and that was great as well. But I didn't care for the finish. At the time, I thought Kane's character was fresh, but now that character is 8 years old and isn't as fresh. The chamber match was pretty good outside of a bad finish. Jericho, Michaels, and Orton carried the bulk of the match, and they got Nash out of there early, which was smart. I thought this was the first time that Goldberg was booked well until the end. Although I did prefer that he won the title in a singles match, getting beat with a sledgehammer was a pretty weak finish, and the idea wasn't the most creative. They could have at least had Hunter drop him with the pedigree afterwards. Overall, a thumbs in the middle show.
Well, there we go. That's all of your feedback for SummerSlam 2003, an event that I think some people enjoyed more than myself in a way. Not a big fan of booking on this show.
I really hated this show. I don't know why.
Hated? That's a strong word.
Well, it's not like this is one of the worst shows we've ever done.
No.
Maybe just because it was neither great nor terrible. It was like just somewhere in the middle. Maybe that's why I hated it so much, because I really had little opinion about anything that went on here. Nothing really stood out. Maybe that's why I disliked it so much.
So that's going to bring us to the end of this week's show. Looking ahead to next week, Wei, what would you like to cure you from this show that you hated?
Okay, well, I'd like to go to a listener's request, actually, and that comes from Keith Matush, who posted on our wall this past week. If we're going to keep doing SummerSlams for the next few weeks, I would like to hear a review of SummerSlam 1993, which featured Taker versus Giant Gonzalez in a rest in peace match, Matt, and the main event of Lex Luger versus Yokozuna.
Well, there you go, everyone. The Lex Express makes its final stop in Auburn Hills, Michigan, to face Yokozuna. And that's what we'll take a look at next week, SummerSlam 1993. As always, we are back late Monday night at midnight Eastern time with our live edition of Review a Raw, which you can listen to at reviewaway.com. That's reviewaway.com. And for those that download the show on Tuesday morning, we will have an interview with Dragon Gate USA and Evolve's Gabe Sapolsky. We're going to be chatting with him about the upcoming Evolve card that's coming up on Tuesday, July the 26th from New York City. So we'll chat with Gabe Sapolsky, and I'm sure we will also chat a little bit about CM Punk and what's been going on. So that's coming up on Tuesday. Fridays, it's Review and Impact, and throughout the week, you can check out all your news at liveaudiowrestling.com, follow us on Twitter at Law Radio, and anywhere else you can possibly find us. We're all over the place, Wei.
Everywhere.
Yes.
Everywhere.
So that's all coming up this week, everybody, and we'll go off here. In honor of Kane and Jim Ross, I want to hear Fire Burning by Sean Kingston.
Huh.
My song of the year for 2009.
Whoa. I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah.
Why?
Because it's Fire burning. I don't know.
All right, cool.
This is what was going through Jim Ross's mind, if he could go into the future.
Somebody call 911. Shawty fire burning on the dance floor. Whoa. What's up, Quan? Kingston, let's go, hey. That super thing, hotter than the sun in the south of Spain. Got me soon as I walk through the door. Oh, my pockets are tickling. The way she dropping low that thing got me wanna spend my money on her. She get it popping like it dropping that birthday cake. Got a candle, need to blow that crazy flame. I take my red black card and my jewelry. Shawty is cool like the fire. Somebody call 911. Shawty fire burning on the dance floor. Whoa, I gotta cool her down. She won't bring the room to ground on the dance floor. Whoa, she's fire burning on the dance floor. That little shorty's fire burning on the dance floor. She's fire burning on the dance floor. That little shorty's fire burning. The order is one in every 100 years, but ain't no doubt I'm taking it home. I'm afraid of golden lanes. Little mama game is about to change. She'll be on covers over the world. She get it popping, like it, dropping that birthday cake. Got a candle, need to blow that crazy flame away. I take my red, black card and my jewelry. Shawty is cool like the fire, cool like fire. Somebody call. Fire burning on the dance floor. Whoa.